Everyone, and welcome to the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners' 14th budget work session. It feels like just this morning we were on 13. Audience members, I want to start by asking you to please silence your electronic devices. And for those presenting today, please turn your mic on when you begin speaking so the green light is showing, and off when you've completed your remarks so the red light is showing. For all presenters, please state your name for the record before speaking or responding to questions. For our first session today, we have an informational board briefing on the FY26 General Fund 5-year forecast update, the long-awaited. So we were going to do General Fund. Oh, do you want to go? You can go. Okay, we'll switch. Okay, you're fine. Okay. Okay, you're going to be here anyway. Okay. So we'll do that second. So
big number.
Do you have everybody you need? Oh, well, then come on down. All right, we'll do the Office of Community Involvement, led by the interim. No, that's okay. There we go. All right, welcome back. Thank you again for your flexibility with all of our, you know, the important work that we had to do this morning. It's sometimes this happens during the budget and we have to be flexible, but appreciate you coming back this afternoon.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Amara Perez. I'm the new director of the Office of Community Involvement. I'm really excited to be here today to talk about OCI and OCI beyond CBACs, in fact. A little bit about our story, mission, strategic vision, and program focus, as well as budget. So I wanted to start with a little historical context. I think origin stories are important, and they can help us generate a shared understanding of intent and also situate a body of work. So wanted to start with a little time travel. Before there was ever an Office of Community Involvement, in 1982, voters first elected what was then called a Citizens Involvement Committee, changed later to the name Community Involvement Committee, or the CIC, to serve as Multnomah County's advisory body on community involvement and engagement. 2 years later, in 1984, an amendment to the county charter established what was then the Office of Citizen Involvement, now Community Involvement, or OCI, to ensure funding and staff support for the CIC and to better develop and maintain community involvement programs. Nearly 10 years later, in a 1995 resolution that was passed, asserted community involvement as a top priority of the county, and that to carry out this commitment, all departments and divisions would adhere to a set of engagement principles, and that the CIC was recognized as the county's lead agency in helping to develop and facilitate community involvement processes and advance improvements to promote civic engagement. In 2019, while still maintaining resources to staff and support the CIC, we actually see the professionalization of OCI and an ordinance change that asserts for the first time that the OCI director will report directly to the chair, plan, implement, coordinate community involvement programs, and provide overall strategic direction for community involvement efforts with the cooperation of departments and divisions. In 2021, May 27th, almost 4 years to this very day, a resolution passed prioritizing Multnomah County's commitment to early, inclusive, and equitable community outreach and engagement, and to support OCI and the CIC in regular evaluations of the many ways that the county engages with the public about programs and policies. So this body of work, each evolution reflected efforts to center community involvement, to embed community engagement in processes countywide as a matter of practice. Next slide, please. It is this story and the action-oriented spirit of the 2021 resolution that actually gives clarity and form to OCI's mission, which is to support departments to create timely and culturally relevant plans for community involvement, to utilize equity-driven approaches in all aspects of community engagement, to prioritize the engagement of historically underrepresented and underserved communities, and to evaluate the diverse ways the county is and can be engaging with the public. Next slide, please. OCI is using a multifaceted approach to this work in service to the mission. OCI collaborates with departments and staff to strengthen program-based engagement, advise on engagement policies and procedures, develop engagement trainings and resources, serve as a community portal to departmental engagement opportunities, and directly support community feedback and county engagement and budget resource allocation. And I want to go through each of these strategic areas and give you just a little sense of what this actually looks like programmatically. Next slide, please. So let's start at the center, which is engage. OCI continues to this day to support the CIC, composed of 15 volunteers that participate in ongoing review of the county's community engagement policies and programs to identify and remove barriers to civic participation. So the CIC uses a range of inquiry activities like interviews and surveys and focus groups, looking at case studies and other kinds of research. Participants create meaningful ways to learn directly from county leaders, frontline staff, and community partners. They reflect on engagement issues and insights, and every year the CIC develops and presents recommendations directly to OCI and the Board of County Commissioners. You will be receiving their letter in the coming days. Next slide, please. In addition to the CIC, you all know very well that OCI supports CBACs. We staff the NONDI and Central CBAC. We provide administrative programmatic guidance to the 9 staff assigned to coordinate their departmental respective CBACs. And this program has many dimensions to it. I could talk more about it, but I think we've had a lot of opportunities to discuss CBAC at length. And I'm confident you all know that the CBAC improvement is OCI's number one priority this year. And we will continue to update you and your offices on that progress soon with an added improvement memo from the Central CBAC. Next slide, please. A second focus area is connect. It is often, OCI is often the first stop for community members who are actually looking for a way to connect. We see our role to serve as a community portal to departmental engagement opportunities, responding to requests and helping people find the right place and the right way to participate. So programmatically, a few activities include outreach at events. I will say that at the last board hearing, we had 16 community members sign up for CBACs, 3 of whom signed up to recruit for CBACs. So we think outreach in-person events are really powerful. Yeah, they're mostly in District 4. pretty sure, yeah. Right. and also opportunities to facilitate community-based civic education on how the county and budget processes work. To honor and celebrate that connection, every year OCI helps organize an annual volunteer recognition event, and that will be coming this summer. Next slide, please. A third focus area is education. With aspirations for OCI to serve as the county's engagement, training, and resource hub, I want to share a few examples of what we've been doing around workshops and resources for the last 8 months to just, again, show what this looks like in practice. In December, OCI helped to bring a public meeting law training conducted by the State of Oregon's ethics team, provided to county staff and also community members that were serving as county officials, a 2-hour hybrid in-person and remote session. To help county staff onboard community members as public officials, this was a high demand from many folks wanting to understand how to do this. We created a checklist with live links to laws, policies, and resources for county staff, and that now lives in Commons for easy access. A resource OCI developed for CBAC participants was a 2-page handout with links to the past 2 years of CBAC budget letters, video recordings of CBAC presentations at the budget work sessions organized by departments, really helping to demystify the culminating work of CBAC efforts. Another example is a resource for county and staff and community members in design now is a thorough, interactive, and engaging curriculum for county and budget 101 workshops. These are some examples of the educational resources and tools that OCI is committed to developing and promoting. Next slide, please. OCI offers guidance on county engagement policies, procedures, and practices. We receive email requests periodically. These are examples on the screen of some of the recent requests that we have been asked to explore with other offices. Guidance around stipends, establishing group agreements, building robust recruitment plans, evaluating bylaws, and collecting demographic data. Next slide, please. OCI is fundamentally about collaborating, working with departments to strengthen engagement practices. We are actively involved in three communities of practice, one for volunteers, one for advisory committees, and we are now launching a new community of practice on engagement. We just had 45 county staff RSVP to join the launch of this new COP this summer. We started a forum for cooperative learning we're calling engagement huddles. These are one-hour, agenda-free dialogues about very targeted engagement issues. The first one being about inclusive outreach, exploring questions like, how can an outreach plan actually aim to mitigate a legacy of exclusion and distrust? In addition to supporting CBACs at large, OCI is very committed and passionate about directly supporting CBAC coordinators through monthly meetings, orientations, retreats, quarterly lunches. We actually see this as a strategic relational model for cross-departmental collaboration. Next slide, please. To support collaboration, OCI has initiated efforts to centralize participant education programs, to survey and illuminate the advisory committee landscape at the county, and to create recruitment tools that aid in our efforts to actively recruit diverse communities that reflect the priorities of inclusive and equitable community outreach and engagement. Next slide, please. And finally, I want to add, in addition to our multifaceted approach to fulfilling our mission, we understand the value of engagement, research, assessment, and evaluation. And while we're still in the early stages of building a robust research practice, we have created a framework for inquiry, one that we believe reflects what we call OCI's data lane, being able to generate data and insights on engagement activities, the staff that support these activities, the communities and participants that are engaged, public perceptions at large, and of course, program assessment. Next slide, please. To stabilize and strengthen OCI and our programs, we prioritized in this budget year capacity building and infrastructure. Critical to that effort was our request for a permanent relationship between the limited duration appointment and OCI. And I just want to thank the chair for investing in this office and approving the LDA position as a permanent FTE. This really allows us to set a permanent scope of work with short and long-term programmatic goals to support and strengthen CBAC policy systems and resources while also building overall capacity for our office. Next slide, please. So with only two FTE up until now, most of our staff time has been attentive to engagement, which is one of our strategies, mostly to sustain the CIC and manage CBACs. With three FTE, we can revamp and transform CBACs, build the much-needed infrastructure, and provide programmatic consistency across the county, while also being able to give more attention to those other program areas that I just outlined. Because our multifaceted model is an integrated strategy that helps us achieve our mission. Next slide. So this graphic helps us to see the FTE position and what I think will be the next milestone on OCI's timeline, as you can see now being able to really expand our capacity. Next slide. Our small but mighty office is largely dedicated, budget is dedicated to personnel cost. 80% of our budget is for personnel cost, which this includes the three FTE. Contractual costs are largely stipends, training workshops, and translation services. Next slide, please. Just another graph that says pretty much the same thing. Next slide. We have no reductions. Next slide. And while I would just end with saying, while our FTE is new, the resources to support it are not. It is my understanding that this position has been LDA for the last four fiscal years. And so it just allows us to have what we need programmatically to strengthen our office. So thank you again, Chair, for making that happen, and I'm happy to answer questions at this time.
Any questions for Amata? You did an excellent job. No questions. Thank you.
Okay, awesome.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I also just want to say I'm trying not to have you do such an excellent job, and the work that you've done in your time here has been fantastic. So I'm really truly taking this office and making it have countywide impact, and I just really want to appreciate you for that.
Thank you. Yeah. That means a lot. I appreciate that, Chair. Thank you.
Yeah. 8 months you've been here?
8 months.
I know.
Yeah.
I was going to say you punch above your weight, but then I was like, is that a 2 month? I don't know.
Thank you.
All right. Now we are going to invite Jeff Renfro. Christian, is she? Can somebody run back in, please, grab Christian?
I think we can also get started if she wants to come join me later.
I just don't want her to miss it. All right. Thank you, Jeff, for coming down for one of the most important parts of this budget process, the May forecast.
Take 25 slides and just cut to the chase.
It's really short. Yeah.
Like the build-up.
Do not pontificate.
For the record, I'm Jeff Renfro from the Budget Office. I use he, him pronouns. Like I said, I think my portion of this will be only 15 minutes. There's not a lot of changes to discuss, so we'll save some time. Can we go to the next slide, please? And we'll just keep going. Can we go one more, please? So to start with the headline, I know this is what you all are interested in. So this is the new revenue that's currently available to allocate for fiscal year 2026. So the first one on top is total ongoing available for next year, $545,000. That's from a new opioid settlement that is allowing the health department to shift some new programming that they'd intended to start in 26 to this opioid revenue. It frees up ongoing general fund, which then you all can allocate. On the one-time only side, we have the two revenue amendments the chair has already discussed, the unused public campaign finance contingency for the current year that we'd roll over, $500,000. Those rent assistance refunds related to our ARP rent assistance program, $113,000 of one-time only. And then the chair referenced this last week, but tomorrow on the board agenda, you're going to have a grant for new gun violence money. So if the board does approve that, then that would increase the amount. What did you
think? It's a prevention.
A gun violence grant, a grant to prevent it. Yeah. That will create additional contingency in the current year, and then we could have a revenue amendment to then roll that over as one time only. So that isn't official yet, but I put it on the list. That would leave $1.1 million of one-time only available.
Can I just add something?
Yeah.
Just because Christian Elkin, County Budget Director, she, her pronouns, for the record, what you'll see in the new opioid settlement revenue is you'll also see a companion department amendment. When I bring the department amendments to you all, budgeting that revenue and then decreasing the general fund expenditures in that program. So we'll try to highlight these as we go through where you see those companion pieces.
What if this has not already been introduced as amendments?
Just the last one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Next slide, please. One more. So we're not making any changes to the forecast and either for the current year or ongoing, which is why we're not changing that. Just a couple of years ago, recording fees are based on housing transactions. At one point, we had the four worst months we've ever had right in a row. So there was our recording fee revenue was almost cut in half at one point. So we're back on the path of recovery. We're just not talking about it because it was already expected and built into the forecast. Next slide, please. So I'm going to talk a little bit about BIT, and I'm going to try to put it in the context of some of the questions that you've had, Commissioner Moyer, about kind of how we're approaching risk around this. And what are the things that we're looking at that will cause us to change our assumptions? So this is current year collections. That's the dotted orange line, and it's compared to where we were at the same point in the last few years in the other colors. So for right now, our assumption for this year is that our revenues relative to last year go up by about 7%. Where we were at the end of April, we're like running just a little bit behind that pace, but May collections in the first year or first week were pretty high, which suggests some of that April collection just spilled over into May. So all that is to say we're on track to be pretty close to what we forecast. If we want to go to the next slide, please. So then this is our actual collections in the solid portion of the purple line, and then the dotted purple and orange portion on the right side is our expectations going forward. The blue line on the left side was our long-term growth rate before the board voted to approve an increase in the rate. And then that green line is the long-term growth rate corrected for that increase in revenue. So as we've talked about in the past, we're still expecting to be running ahead of our long-term growth rate. That's mainly due to the changes in federal tax policy during the first Trump administration that sort of permanently bumped that up. At some point in the future, we'll revisit our assumption of what our long-term growth rate should be to better reflect that, but I think we're still a little bit early. We're assuming that after 2 years of decline coming out of that big spike we had during the pandemic, that we're going back to a prolonged period of growth. The amount of uncertainty we see in the economy makes that like a little bit shakier than what that assumption was even a year ago, but we'll get into why we're sticking with that for now. But we're assuming between 5% and 6% annual growth going forward. If we could go to the next slide, please. So these are the two considerations we're trying to balance when we think about that. This is a really complicated graph that you don't need to even like really look at what's on it. It's just kind of a prop for me to talk about. So the graph is from a Goldman Sachs report that just came out. And basically what this graph is showing is that when you have something that like weird that happens in the economy or some sort of event that could cause the direction of economic growth to change, the lines in gray, red, and blue are measures, like qualitative measures of people's feelings about the economy. And then that blue line is sort of an index of like hard data when the actual economic data changes. So what this shows is that people's feelings about the economy are sometimes faster to react than the actual hard economic data. So what I put on the left there, I'd originally written that differently, and Christian told me to make the language more accessible. But it's really like the vibes, or use economics language, the animal spirits, right, really, really drive some of this. And as we're thinking about what are the things that could cause an economic contraction, one of the things we've talked about in the past is recessions really happen at like millions of dinner tables across the country and in millions of staff meetings, right? So it's everyone kind of all at the same time going, you know, I'm like a little bit worried about my job, so let's not remodel our kitchen this year. Or like, you know, we can drive our car for another year longer, right? Everyone does that at once and the economy contracts as everyone pulls back. So what we're seeing in the qualitative data right now is there's a lot of anxiety about the economy and the type of anxiety that would maybe anticipate slowing in that type of consumption. So we're seeing a downturn in consumer sentiment, and then also people's expectations about inflation going forward have really spiked. Yesterday, some new consumer sentiment data came out that showed it rebounding a little bit. It's still down lower than we'd like it to be, but it's not quite like at the rock bottom level that it was a month ago. So balancing what seems like people getting nervous in a way that could easily translate to a slowdown in hard economic indicators. But then when we go to the next slide, please, Tasia. But then when we look at the hard data, this is an update on U.S. corporate profits. This is one I show almost every time we do this. This is really what's driving our BIT revenue. So it's gone up even higher than the last time I showed you. And when we look at the expected payments going forward, this is totally consistent with our expectation that the BIT will grow by another 5 or 6% next year. So I'm looking for cracks in the hard data and continuing to watch kind of how sentiment could maybe push that in the future. I'm still really worried about the sentiment, but the hard data continues to be extremely solid. Until we see something more definitive, I think we're going to assume that the portions of the economy that drive our revenues that we're mostly focused on are gonna continue to grow. If we wanna go to the next slide, please. The other piece that is concerning, and this is one that I expect to change over the summer, this is looking at the CPI West Size A, which is the measure of inflation that we use at the county. It is built into our labor contracts and our agreements with our CBOs, so it is how we calculate our COLA. So it has continued to plateau. It's kind of not quite as low as the Federal Reserve would like it to be, but it is significantly lower than it was in the past. And this is a place where, kind of when all of the tariffs were announced, there was a big reaction in the financial markets to it. And then in that qualitative data I was talking about, you see people's anxiety and references to uncertainty really spike. What's notable is that was people reacting to a plan about something that was going to happen in the future. And actually a lot of the actual thing that is going to happen hasn't really hit us yet. So when you look at the import data and data around shipping, particularly from Asia, you see a big spike in imports as people are trying to ship things over to get them in before the tariffs take effect. And that's ended. So I think the next time we get an update on shipping into like Long Beach and California, we'll see a pretty significant decline in ships that are docking there. So that's why I think over the summer, we'll start to see prices inch up. Hopefully they inch up and they don't spike, with the caveat being that maybe when I go back upstairs to my desk and I look at the news, we'll see that tariffs have been delayed again. So impossible to predict what's going on right now, but our expectation is that inflation will start to go back up. So we'll continue to watch it over the summer, and then when we come back in November, we'll have an update of where our expectations are in the long term. Next slide, please. And then this is the last one I'm just going to show every time we meet. This is initial weekly unemployment claims. Like we've talked about, this is going to be our first indicator that we're starting to see significant job losses. So we've talked about before, it is still at a historically low level. So next slide, please. And one more. Like I said, we're not making any changes to the five-year forecast, but I do want to highlight one thing here. In fiscal year 2028, we have that increase in our expected deficit. And I've talked about a lot of that is due to something that's going on with PERS that is potentially going to increase our PERS rates by like 2.5%. And it has to do with essentially the side account that we started when the PERS system pooled all its resources expiring. So either next week or the week after, there's going to be a big meeting about the changes that the PERS board is considering. To avoid those increases, or at the very least kind of spread them out so they don't hit everyone all at once. So hopefully in the near future, we'll have better information about what that PERS increase in 2028 will look like, and we'll build that into future forecasts. Next slide, please. One more. So contingency update for the current year. We still have $446 in regular contingency. Typically, $446,000. I said 446. Yeah. We've got a big problem. I'll say it so that Christian doesn't have to. Typically, we recommend leaving about $500,000 in there in case in June we have like a weather event or something like that. That leaves $478,000 in total non-earmarked contingency. We still have that public campaign finance earmark of $500,000, but there's an amendment to roll that over to use this one time only for next year. Next slide, please. Just as a reminder of a few of our risks, significant number of our employees have open labor contracts right now. That and the BIT are really the two things that could change our financial outlook really quickly. There's a whole variety of state and federal changes that you're all aware of. The economic uncertainty makes it so that it is both difficult to anticipate what's going to happen and then creates some significant downside risk for us. And then the last thing I briefly wanted to touch on, it's based on some of the conversation from this morning in the DART presentation. So I know that you all probably read about Big Pink and PacWest going up for sale. So I wanted to just briefly discuss kind of the implications of that. So where we are right now with property taxes is basically everyone's office buildings or their property downtown is worth less than what it was before the pandemic. And we sort of don't know by exactly how much, just because there haven't been enough market transactions to establish like what the value of anything is. So in that uncertainty, what we've assumed in the forecast is that those office buildings, and this is based on the way that Mike's team incorporates that into the tax roll, those values will continue to trend down. And whether they trend down because people successfully appeal their values or because there are transactions that update the model that push everyone's values down, it's sort of two different vehicles that get us to the same place. So right now, we're assuming that fiscal year 2026 would be the last year of really significant declines. And that would take a lot of the value of those big office properties down to something like a 70% decline from what they were valued at before the pandemic. Yeah. 70. Yeah. A 70% decline. Yeah. So if you look at what the asking price is for Big Pink, that corresponds to an 80% decline. And the way that compression works is the difference between, you know, 60 and 70% is not as big as the difference between 70 and 80%. So it potentially, as we go even lower, if we get much below 70%, like the revenue impacts will pick up more quickly. There's several developers that I talk to about sort of development and property tax related issues. And when I talked to them after the sale of Big Pink was announced, I heard potential sale prices that were above that $70 million. So hopefully we end up higher than that. I would say that if those buildings are sold for a 70% decline relative to pre-pandemic values, that's not great, but it would be in line with our expectations. And I wouldn't expect us to make significant changes to the forecast. If it does sell for something like 80%, we might come back in November and update our revenue assumption for fiscal year 2027. So we're really at this point where we've assumed that values have really declined significantly. And then as we sort of true up to exactly where they land, it has implications for 27. But I think from our narrow perspective, a few market transactions that establish a new floor, that would just help everyone understand, like, what is the situation that we're in right now? What are these buildings actually worth? I think will actually allow people to move forward instead of kind of being paralyzed by the uncertainty right now. And from a revenue perspective, we would bottom out and then go back to that sort of steady 3% growth. So with that, I think the last slide just says questions. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Really appreciate this. Thank you, Christian. This is the board's chance to ask a very smart economist any of your questions that you have about our economy, as well as, you know, any information or clarity you want on our specific revenue forecast.
I just have snide remarks about capitalism, so I'll go into that.
I have actually a question. So you said, just your last statement was you bottom out and then you just slowly build out of it. How long after this bottom out, how long would it take to get back to where we were? Is that at 3% a year?
Oh.
Right?
Yeah, 3% a year, but because the real market value didn't start pushing assessed value down until for most of these buildings they hit 60 or 70% declines. I could do the actual math, but I think it would take us something like 5 years, maybe.
And then my other question is, so when a building sells for more, say 15% more, we don't actually get the new value. But if a building sold for significantly less and it dropped below the assessed value, that the sale value, it potentially would be the new.
It's a little bit more complicated. So what would happen is it doesn't like automatically reset. So the sale value doesn't automatically become the real market value. So two things could happen. If it's a market transaction, then a significantly lower value would be built into Mike and his team's modeling, and it would reduce the values of kind of all of the related properties. But for that one property, it wouldn't necessarily reduce it all the way down to the sale price.
Unless they appealed it?
Unless they appeal. But then even the appeal, that would be like one piece of evidence that the property owner would use to make the case that their property was significantly less, but there would be other comparables that they would use. But it certainly reduces it. It's just like a little bit complicated how it works through the system.
So is the summary is, you think we're close to the bottom, and just testing this, and that you've taken into account what you know about the broader environment, that it's not going to be a further rally?
I think we're close to the bottom, but the issue is that last like 5 or 10% there like has bigger revenue implications than the first 40%.
Because of the compression.
Yeah. So as we're kind of truing up to like where we think the actual bottom is, we might have to change the forecast still.
Then just one other question. And this is a question for the chair. You already put the revenue amendment on the table for the 500 and the 113, right?
Yeah.
So the new piece is just the gun violence grant swap?
Yeah.
My mic wasn't on. Yes, to both your questions. All right, any other questions? I have a question, and I should know this. So when we did the changes, and I think, was it back in 2019 about the BAT tax increase?
It was in February 2020. It was great timing.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, that was.
Yeah.
We also made a change where we took, was it about 2,400 small businesses or 1,400? There was, I shouldn't be quoting an actual number since it was so long ago, but it was basically like we also changed the BIT and who it applied to so that there were a lot of smaller businesses that for whom it no longer had to pay it, correct?
Yeah, and I don't remember exactly the number of businesses that were now excluded, but we raised the threshold.
Yes.
So you have to have a certain level of revenue before you even paid the tax. And then we also increased the proprietor's compensation. I'm looking for Eric, not here. So the amount that the owner of a business is allowed to pay themselves tax-free before it becomes taxable, we also increased that as well.
Okay.
So there were some specifically like helping small businesses to lower their tax burden, and while we increase the tax, which is generally on larger firms.
Yeah, and I appreciate the slide that showed the corporate taxes and like the increase in corporate tax, or sorry, not corporate, corporate profits, the slide on corporate profits that we're seeing. If you could just follow up with some information about the sizes of the business and how many we have paying that are above, let's say a threshold of like, you know, $20 million. You know what I mean? I'm trying to get a who's paying, like how much we're reliant on the largest businesses for the BIT.
Yeah, I mean, so I can follow up on that. I'll say typically, you know, a huge payment is like $4 million. And then generally our rule of thumb, it's been pretty steady, is that 10 firms pay us. It's most recently been around 20% of our total BIT collections, which is 36 million dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 firms are responsible for $36 million in BIT. And then when you incorporate the top 300 firms, it's like 60% of our BIT. So some years, you know, 2 or 3% of our discretionary general fund is based on the profitability of of one firm.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate that. All right. Great. We are going to now move on to our next part of our work session. So thank you for the May forecast. Not huge changes. Now we're welcome to the communications office. Julie Sullivan Springetti, welcome. Okay, and yes, thank you. And Commissioner Jones Dixon is excused to join virtually, and then we'll be stepping out at 3 o'clock. Yes.
And it was 50,000 to 100,000. Good afternoon, Chair and Commissioners. Julie Sullivan Springetti, share her pronouns, Communications Director, here with Dennis Sorrell, Deputy Director, and our Communications Office staff to seek your support for the FY 2026 budget. It's a budget made possible only by Christian Elkin and Jeff Renfro and Aaron Russell, so thank you. Slide two, please. Oregon Territory, Multnomah County, Portland City. The County Commissioners of Multnomah County met pursuant to an act of the Legislative Assembly passed by the House of Representatives in December AD 54 and the Council December AD 1854. Present were George W. Vaughn and Emsley Scott, absent James Bybee. The bond of Shubrick Norris as County Auditor was presented and approved by the Board of Commissioners. On motion, it was ordered that the county auditor be authorized to procure books, stationery, et cetera, for the use of his office, also stationery for the use of the Board of County Commissioners. On motion adjourned, 2 p.m. Thus reads the first public record created by the first Board of County Commissioners on January 17, 1855, which was 4 years before Multnomah County became before Oregon became a state. We've always been Multnomah County. Slide three, please. From day one, this board recognized that the only way to run a democracy was openly, creating a record that captured their actions, invited scrutiny, and accepted accountability. That sacred pledge comes down to Multnomah County today. Slide four, please. Making our representative government visible, accessible, and accountable is the Communications Office vision and mission. Last November 17th, the county took a historic step, another one, toward transparency. By launching the first online public records request center called GovQA with the help of Paul DeBruler in IT. The communications office hired the county's first public records response manager, Shannon Coyle, an expert public administrator who is working department by department to build a true system, developing the software, identifying and training records custodians, setting up operational practices, producing training guides, videos, and a countywide fee schedule. Slide five, please. Congratulations to the Sheriff's Office, the first to go live. And in the months since, elections, animal services, purchasing, and communications have filled more than 2,970 requests through mid-May. More departments are coming online every month. Importantly, we are committed to making this online system, which many people feared would lose the human touch, one that puts the public first. So when one of the county's most frequent requesters struggled to use the new system, Shannon and a colleague drove to Lake Oswego May 13th to address that person's challenges in person, and then worked with our software developer to make improvements based on the meeting. Slide six, please. The communications office is the county's work group that links people to the county services, responds to the press, and connects county employees to one another. We have no travel and training budget. We never have. But we're resourceful and have become one of the most experienced and disaster-ready staff at the county, qualified at the federal level in incident command, and this year alone trained to respond to earthquakes, terrorism, and a mass casualty event at PDX, all at no cost to the general fund. Slide seven, please. Our highest best use is saving lives. On January 17th, the temperature dropped, the wind came up, not enough to open shelters, but enough to start what would be the longest enhanced operation activation in county history. Slide eight, please. As this office has done every emergency since the Eagle Creek fire in 2017, we activated when emergency management did, working with Health Officer Bruno and Emergency Management Director Voss. We developed the top three messages of the day that everyone in this region, including the city of Portland and Gresham, share. We create short, shareable PSAs on cold-related illness, carbon monoxide poisoning, fall prevention, and safe driving. The message is broadcast in English, Spanish, and with our regional disaster preparedness partners, 5 other languages. Slide 9, please. On February 4th, when the chair declared the first of 2 states of emergency around life-threatening cold, we ramped up to full, issuing daily detailed press releases, daily press conferences, escorting reporters, and pushing coordinated social media calibrated to the day's top messages. Slide 10, people. People at risk have to be able to know where they can get help. And as you know, we have no standing emergency shelters, and locations change daily based on need, building availability, even broken water pipes. So every morning, immediately after shelter locations are chosen, Janet Quantores, our lone graphic designer, designs a walking street map in English and Spanish that 211, Portland Fire, PPB, and the Sheriff's Hope Team, and every outreach worker physically hand to people outside. Slide 11, please. After learning from street volunteers what would work better, Janet pivoted mid-emergency to adding photos to the exterior so that it showed the exterior of shelters so people didn't even have to know addresses, helping attract more than 700 people to safety in those few days. Our approach to our work is to acknowledge that we make mistakes every day. We miss an audience, we anger a partner like TriMet, but then we try to rigorously see our gaps and our issues and learn from them. Slide 12, please. The maps were among 280 graphics Janet created this year so people know where to get the services they need, including this new brochure for veteran services or advertisements for county services that run in tiny, culturally specific newspapers. She also designed 27 of the county's most scrutinized public reports, including the Homelessness Response Action Plan and Domicile Unknown. Throughout, she advises graphic designers across the county on the county's style guide, the guide she wrote. Slide 13, please. In an emergency, the county needs shelter staff. And today, more county employees are trained and are volunteering that at any time, a dramatic increase that the Department of County Human Services attributes largely to Paul Park, the office's internal communications coordinator. Quietly and on top of his regular work, Paul waged a year-long campaign to recruit employees in the public through new web pages, dozens of recruitment emails, and with videographer Mark Baker, inspiring videos of our colleagues describing why they volunteer. Paul's new challenge is helping staff in the community make sense of the Trump executive orders, a critical part of the COO and government relations team. To that end, he developed the Commons web pages on how to respond to ICE and what is permissible around advocacy. Paul said his goal is to reduce anxiety by letting staff know that someone is tracking, assessing, and interpreting all this chaos, that someone is keeping a watchful eye. It's the kind of thoughtfulness and follow-through that led 2 different work groups to nominate him and Paul to be selected as the Superior Public Service for the Superior Public Service to Internal Customers Award. Slide 14, please. Every organization needs people willing to run into burning buildings, and the communications office are those people. My colleague Dennis is first among equals. As our lead media spokesperson, he jumps in. He's a world-class editor, a bulldog behind the scenes, pushing, including today, for corrections and clarifications in newsprint. He daily brings our partners into coordinating our comms with everyone from the mayor's team and co-leads the regional, county, and city PIOs, which is a formal group. In February, as in every emergency activation since he arrived at the county, Dennis finished his workday and then went to the emergency shelter to work overnight. This year, he pulled a double shift. His example has been followed by Julia Combs, bringing her critical people skills, and Alicia Mendez, the only Spanish speaker at the shelter, to directly help unhoused neighbors. They show up. Slide 15, please. Misinformation is rampant in health news, and we work to ensure the health department is a trusted source for our community to alert them to dangers, direct them to help, and land messages. We're the top source of local health news in the state. As the sole spokesperson for the health department, Sarah Dean's range is wide, from creating the media package around 250 new stabilization and recovery beds to showcasing teens working on an EPA grant to improve air quality to managing the sensitive public information around a rare case of infectious tuberculosis in a local middle school. Slide 16, please. It's work deeply grounded in community. Sarah personally interviewed every grieving family featured in Domicile Unknown, bearing witness and telling the stories of people like Colby here, pictured here with his mom. In March, a young woman was found deceased in her tent in the Madison neighborhood. But for 3 weeks, she was unidentified. 3 weeks, nobody knew who she was. The medical examiner finally contacted Sarah, who issued a press release April 1st, and within hours, the woman's family saw Sarah's efforts and called, finally locating their loved one.
Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, Commissioners. For the record, Dennis Thrault, AC and his pronouns. My first time, I think, sitting with all of you this way, so thank you for having
welcome.
Me. Next slide, please. So media interest in the county continues to set records. That's not surprising, I think, given the critical work we do and all the ways our work intersects with the crises of our times. And we want to be especially clear, this is not unwelcome. We see this scrutiny as absolutely essential. We depend on the media to hold us accountable, to accurately communicate our priorities and our positions, and share them with the community at large. Next slide, please. So if you count every story we worked on with a reporter, every story published about Multnomah County, and all of the stories and release that our team drafts from multco.us, you could see we've gone from 375 in fiscal year 2016 to just shy of 3,400 today. That's a roughly ninefold increase. And I want to be clear, we've got receipts. We track this in a spreadsheet that gets updated weekly. And we're seeing this wave of scrutiny surge even as newsrooms across our county continue to shrink and roil with turnover. And still, we have adapted to the media landscape we face. For the outlets that have managed to add or keep reporters that stay focused on our work or on the county's work, we've actually built some pretty good proactive relationships. Next slide, please. And for other reporters, we've worked to prioritize education, helping people accurately report what they're seeing in complicated issues. So one of these was the recent rollout of our new Homeless Services Department dashboard. We had a work session, live training session shown here on Zoom. We also provided background docs for that. And another example was just a few weeks ago, clearly right on time for the weather that I feel a little overdressed for right now, when we gave reporters a detailed look at the health impacts of heat. Next slide, please. But one of our, I think, biggest challenges this year was ranked choice voting. So sharing information with 575,000 registered voters and a few dozen reporters and editors loomed as a gargantuan mission for the Elections Division. That's why last summer, Elections worked with our team to conduct a media walkthrough for the county's new ballot reporting system. It's one example. We did it with dummy numbers, and we just wanted to make sure that when the real numbers dropped on election night, reporters knew where to look, what to do, and how to describe what they were seeing. Next slide, please. We also sent a series of news releases throughout the election, and our team worked with Elections to dive deep into the fundamentals of ranked choice voting. Crucially, we helped answer some pretty basic but important questions. Questions like, how can we trust these results? How can we trust this new system? And later this summer, when staff spent a hot week down in the basement of Elections, they were testing this new system for how to hand count a recount election. We were there to film it, we wrote about it, and we shared that information with news outlets who then shared it with their readers, and it actually bought some trust. Polling after the election showed our collective efforts, Elections, the city of Portland, our team, they all made a difference. And as ranked choice voting returns next year, which I know everyone here is tracking very closely, we will be ready for round two. Next slide, please. And as you can see on the slide here, sometimes we've had to do our work on a moment's notice. When we learned someone had put an incendiary device in one of our ballot return boxes, our team rallied around Elections and worked with partners, including law enforcement, and we did that work not just locally, but across state lines. That's the partnership that this communications team brings. We know how to work with folks. We issued a clear, accurate release within hours. We held a press conference where all the partners gathered together, and we told people what we knew and what we didn't. Elections Director Tim Scott actually said later he heard from people nationally about our work, sharing that information, that they wanted to emulate what they saw from us in that day. Next slide, please. And then even more recently, in January, we leapt into action when a group of people broke windows at Elections overnight on a holiday weekend. We put out a statement once again we worked with law enforcement partners and our workplace security folks to share images and video footage, and we got Tim ready once again for a gauntlet of TV interviews. We want to be clear, operating Elections is one of the county's most bedrock and essential functions. And yes, we are blessed to have a stellar Elections team, But that doesn't matter if people lose trust or if this county gives people reasons to lose trust. And that's why we are here doing our work. In all cases, our goal is to preserve and enhance the trust that people have. Next slide, please. So there aren't just fewer reporters right now. Their worth is also being measured in clicks and speculative X posts instead of on the impact their stories make. Negative and sensational news almost always right now trumps positive news. And to be sure, negative stories, as we said before, they help us identify gaps. They push us to improve. But the reality is, in an environment like this, stories about good developments, earnest policy debates, even just noting that there were problems that people reported on that we've since fixed, those increasingly go uncovered. So you don't necessarily see people in the media whose lives are better because of county services, people in substance use treatment, people who've moved from tents into shelter beds and apartments, people working jobs where they now give back to others, or people adopting pets who now become wise old little soulmates for them. But our team sees them, we report them, and we share them. Next slide, please. Julia Combs covers homeless services. It's probably one of the most complicated jobs at the county, and I say that because I had that job before Julia joined us 2 years ago, and I want to call out what a difference she's made. Julia tirelessly responds to critical reporters, wrangling policy staff, political staff, provider staff, other communication staffers, and on, to generate hundreds of pages of accurate responses, pointed quotes, and deep background information. That's the brainy part of her work, but I want to tell you a little about the heart, too. Julia's arrival has allowed us to finally share many of those personal stories that I was talking about earlier, the things that emerged from our work. Last summer, she told the story of Monique, you can see her on the slide there, who struggled with homelessness and addiction before entering residential treatment and then an apartment. And I'll read a small quote. It actually ties to the image we have of Monique sitting on her couch right there. For Monique, the centerpiece of her home is the couch, a brown sectional. It's a place where she and her daughter hang out, watching TV and movies together. And it's also a point of pride. It was the first piece of furniture in her apartment that she was able to buy herself. Next slide, please. Julia also finds ways to teach the community more about work they may not understand or realize is happening at the scale we're funding, like street outreach. She is a force multiplier. She convenes a monthly work group of all of our providers' communications reps, and she helped co-create a marketing campaign of stories, videos, and social media posts that showed how caseworkers do their work and how they make such an outsized impact. Next slide, please. And while managing this boom in homelessness coverage, like the intergovernmental agreement that happened last year, supportive housing services questions, our office has also taken on work around behavioral health and our new deflection and sobering services. Once more, as the county grows and adapts, so must our communications team. Next slide, please. This surge was great enough that we requested help from the health department's communications team. And very fortunately, they loaned us Wade Nkrumah, a limited duration employee who was not included in their 2026 budget. In just a few short months, Wade, a former journalist who covered City Hall for the Oregonian, he has been essential to our team as a utility infielder. He jumped into behavioral health coverage, but also coverage of the board, our proclamations, and so many other needs. But where Wade has really shined is his coverage of the Behavioral Health Resource Center. That's an example of a program that faced blistering media scrutiny, but now, as things have turned around, curiously sees little ongoing interest. Wade worked with our visual team to pour his skills and passion into a powerful series of stories, photographs, and videos, essentially a mini marketing campaign to tell people about this facility. Wade took us from the van in Old Town where people get coffee and a nudge to services, all the way inside the facility and beyond, telling us the stories of people who are now stable, sober, and housed. Next slide, please. And while we tell stories about people like Monique or the folks at the BHRC, we also tell stories about Multnomah County's bricks, mortar, and steel. So just before 8 p.m. on April 29th, the Hawthorne Bridge became seriously stuck mid-lift. We've all been in that position, sometimes waiting. Within 20 minutes, the county's Low and Transportation and Bridge PIO, Sarah Hurwitz, had a news release ready for reporters. But the reality is, outside of things like that, most of the time, getting the media to cover our safety and maintenance needs, it's kind of a dead end. Fortunately, Sarah has really good party planner skills. So when we had a recent project that needed some community input, Sarah got a multilingual walking tour organized and brought people down to the troubled road. Oh, does the county desperately need state funding for roads and bridges? Sarah got almost every local news outlet to travel to Far East County with Commissioner Jones Dixon and these county mayors to tell people why we need those dollars, what they're gonna do, and not once, but twice. Next slide, please.
She's the best.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner. A voice from above.
The voice from above coming down, yeah.
Jensen Center God.
Sorry.
So, on that note, Sarah helped host a breakfast on the bridge and a lively evening at OMSI to build participation in an online survey for the earthquake-ready Burnside Bridge. These events, complete with media coverage and social media, actually helped generate nearly 20,000 survey responses. And all the while, Sarah was quietly building a history of the county's Willamette River bridges, producing 6 cinematic videos that this month were nominated for a regional Emmy Award. It's not just the TV folks that compete still, apparently. Next slide, please. Yes, we hope so, yeah. Not the fancy, the local ones. Yeah.
Regional Emmys?
Yeah, regional, nice. Yeah. But Sarah often works with Jason Rutherford, one of 2 videographers in communications who have produced together 115 original videos this year. Jason is a breaking news photographer, and when the community was furious about the closure of the Stark Street Bridge, Jason and Sarah flew into action. They produced a video that gave the community an inside glimpse at the initial collapse of the bridge, and they showed all of the repair steps. They told the story through 2 of the county's road maintenance supervisors. The video was shared widely within the affected community, more than 1,200 views, and it greatly reduced rumors and tension. Next slide, please. Jason's reach actually spreads well beyond county government. So he rapidly and regularly provides B-roll to news stations who can't get to an event or a shelter, but who still want to cover what's going on. And as you'll see here from this still, he produced a training video that the Portland Police Bureau uses to help inform their teams about deflection services. So that's helping our partners. Next slide, please. But Jason, like so many of our team, excels at showing the impact of our services through profound human stories. Like John, who pulled himself out of homelessness just 60 days after going to the Behavioral Health Resource Center. Caseworkers watching the interview commented on how well Jason respects and connects with individuals. Jason says, "I want to show folks who've gone through hard times extra respect, especially as they trust me to tell their story, bearing their soul." Jason is one of 7 members in our team who are award-winning print or broadcast journalists. And this training, we believe at least, makes us a formidable newsroom to cover county news and make the work of our departments and this board increasingly visible.
No one makes the county more visible than Matoya Nakamura, an award-winning photographer so talented that I was at his desk 2 weeks ago when the Portland Art Museum called to say they were acquiring 2 of his pieces for the museum's permanent collection. Every day, Matoya creates a visual record of this. Oh, next slide, please. There we go. Every day, Matoya creates a visual record of this place in this time. On May 14th, Matoya arrived at the employee recognition event here at the Chair's Award. Next slide, please. Then that night, he covered the budget hearing. And between the 2 events, he took 1,400 photos. Since last April, he has taken 141,458 pictures. Next slide, please. He produces the news of record, like the swearing in of new commissioners, like Commissioner Megan Moyer. Next slide. Commissioner Shannon Singleton. Next slide. Commissioner Julia Brim Edwards. Next slide. Commissioner Vince Jones Dixon. Next slide. His work, he has no photo studio, so he hauls lights and backdrops into this room to take formal portraits of county employees like COO Christopher Neal and all of you. Next slide. He works just as hard to make photos for our health clinic's marketing materials or show our essential county partners doing their work every day. Next slide. Record community meetings. Next. And celebrations. Next. And proclamations. Although actually this one was taken by Alicia Mendez while Matoya was in Japan competing in an exclusive international martial arts tournament. Yeah, 6th degree black belt. Next slide. Oh, okay, more importantly, Matoya makes respectful and hauntingly beautiful portraits of the clients we serve, from preschools to shelter to care centers. The photos are shared as public records on our free downloadable Flickr account. Frankly, we serve as a wire service for more than a few local news outlets, At times, Metoyer's photos have run on Willamette Week's website as often as they have Multco.us. Our stories and these photos, which we make sure to share with our partners, are critical to communicating what the county and this board is all about. It's one more adaptation we've led through this office. As the Pew Research Center reports, a higher percentage of people now get their news about local government than from daily newspapers or weekly newspapers. Next slide. That is why, beyond our stories and videos, we create and manage 21 dynamic websites, including Multco.us, while departments manage the static web pages listing, say, clinic hours. We're constantly updating these pages to meet the day's news. Our homepage features the top three county issues of the day and six news stories or releases updated almost daily, stories that in the last year drew more than 400,000 views. Next slide. We build often on very short deadlines, web pages on everything from the climate lawsuit to the homelessness response action plan to deflection and sobering. They join sites on cold weather and hot weather, including Paul Park's volunteer recruitment page. Next slide, please. There's also the county's first bargaining page, which web specialist Andrea Coughlin created to keep everyone up to date on our multiple contract negotiations. When she saw the page earlier this month, Cessa Diaz in Human Resources said, "Huge kudos. We've never had a resource like this for bargaining, so your efforts to get this up and running will be greatly appreciated, not only by our team, but by staff and managers across the county." Next slide, please. Still, Andrea's biggest role on the team is to assemble, curate, and edit the Wednesday Wire, a weekly newsletter published 50 times a year that pulls every county employee into a virtual employee lounge to share the good work we're doing, notify us where to sign up for benefits, who's retiring, what HR is announcing. Next slide. Wednesday Wire, since the pandemic, has grown wildly in popularity, stretching more than 26 pages some weeks as employees share more and more and ask for more and more. Andrea uses the Wednesday Wire and social media to model accessibility for everyone in this organization, training all county employees on how to produce accessible material and often connecting them with their forever pet, like Daisy. Her superpower is constantly pushing to prioritize the voices of people harmed by organizational missteps or preemptively identifying pitfalls that have a strong potential to cause harm to employees or members of the public belonging to marginalized community. Slide, next slide, please. On a team of people doing multiple jobs, Alicia Mendez pulls triple duty. She's the PIO for Animal Services, the county's bilingual bicultural PIO, and our backup social media. When Shannon visited the records requester, that was Alicia with her. And at the same time, she's always working to promote Animal Services, marketing a weekend adoption event that led to 49 families finding a pet and coordinating COINS Second Chance Pets feature monthly. Next slide, please. Alicia makes it her personal mission to reach our Spanish-speaking community. She manages Condado de Multnomah, I did not speak Spanish, the county's only social media platform for Spanish speakers. This has become crucial as our community lost Univision, the region's only Spanish language TV station this year. Alicia stepped in on a recent TB case to immediately translate the press release and deliver the news to the few remaining Spanish-speaking reporters in the region. Next slide, please. There are dedicated social media managers at the county, but not in central communications. Along with Andrea and Alicia, this vital role, which has built the county's largest online audiences, is shared by and most recently led by Jessica Morkert Shipley. In her day job as the spokesperson for the Department of County Human Services, Jessica is our most reliable pitcher of positive stories. She actually got a station to cover how the county helped an 80-year-old Portlander find a home and health care and got the headline, "Your tax dollars at work." But what she really brings to social media is pure breaking news instinct. "This work," she says, "is in my blood." She's personally dedicated to battling misinformation, particularly around elections. Next slide. Jessica believes you can't underestimate the impact of social media on behavior. Simply showing voters casting their ballots and sharing voter turnout numbers can encourage people to return their own ballot. A post about recent voters' registration deadline at the end of last month was garnered 257 shares on Meta. That's just one example of the reach. Next slide, please. But in this dizzying race for attention, we can confirm that running a government account in this social media environment is brutal. For more than 2 years, we have been gravely concerned about the racism and vitriolic attacks on community members and employees when we post on the platform X. While we maintain our presence on the platform to reach more than 54,000 followers during an emergency, we post regularly on X less and less. Instead, we launched a new account on Blue Sky and are building a new audience there. Metro and Washington County noticed, they contacted us and got our materials, and then they followed suit. Next slide, please. No one is holding our practices up to a light more critically and driving us to improve than Ryan Yambra. He's the best known PIO inside the county because he works across so many departments, helping DART with property tax materials, recruiting parole and probation officers for the Department of Community Justice, holding press conferences on sobering. He then acted as the guy in the handcuffs you see here in the training video for Portland Police to train officers for the Coordinated Care Pathway Center. He's also our own little director of marketing and innovation, helping departments post billboards on weatherization, driving an overhaul of our Instagram page, and getting a preschool for all signed in every newly enrolled family's yard. Ryan and teammates can do this only, however, as department budgets allow, as we have no discretionary funds for marketing. Next slide, please. Ryan has been frustrated by the media's sometimes fact-light treatment of Preschool for All. So last month, he worked with director Leslie Barn to host a live Ask Me Anything on the R Portland subreddit. They answered really tough questions for 2 hours, and the event drew 35,000 views and applause. Said one Redditor, since no one else is really saying this, thank you for making yourselves available in a forum like this. It's very rare for program staff to do this, but very valuable. And it's not the easiest thing to do with the highly visible and contentious program you manage. Solid public servant move. Next slide, please. So what does all this churn and burn cost? As you can see, our proposed budget for FY26 is almost entirely a general fund. It's $3.2 million, a reduction of 3.6%. And you can see the tiny ask in the proposed budget for the Preschool for All position. Next slide, please. Here's our five-year trend in hiring. The changes you see are where the board invested since 2020 in the county's changing needs, allowing us to hire Alicia, the bilingual, bicultural Spanish language PIO, a second videographer who was tasked with reaching culturally specific groups easier and faster. Instead of waiting for translations, we put a native speaker up delivering the message that way. And of course, we hired Paul to connect our COVID fractured staff to one another through his award-winning internal communications. And then last fall, we were so lucky to add Shannon as our public records manager, a position that the county attorney insisted be in the communications office. And Jenny Madker, you were right. Next slide, please. Here's the financials on salaries, supplies, et cetera. As you can see, our budget is almost all people. We've reduced our small supply budget, which pays for things like cameras, hard drives, the delivery of podiums every time you see the podium in public, placards at press conferences, and to support the photography that all departments ask us to, including the new district attorney. Next slide, please. And here are the people. Here's our org chart. Here's everybody who works here. You can see boxes with stripes are no longer funded in this proposed budget. Next slide, please. It also reflects the permanent reduction of one of our two videographer positions. Next slide. And it shows two new positions that we have requested, one general fund and one Preschool for All. Next slide. So how do we arrive at this? Well, let's go back to this slide and Back to, is that one more? And, nope, back, go ahead, forward. Nope, yep, to this boardroom last year, the chair and Commissioner Brim Edwards were gentle but definitely chastised me for not asking for the positions needed for this team given the community interest in behavioral health, preschool for all, and what is increasingly an active board. So this year, in an effort to truly address what the community needs, I asked for an additional PIO and a person to promote preschool for all. Next slide, please. Of course, these aren't boxes. Next slide. No more than our clients, our numbers, they're people. And no matter what, if you look at this picture, we're losing one. Next slide, please. In 2008, during the writer's strike, Mark Baker left his life as a Hollywood filmmaker to take care of his mom in Gladstone. While she was recovering, he decided to finish his film degree at Portland State, and it was there he saw an ad that Multnomah County needed a video intern. Mark applied, was hired, and has been showing this community what the county does ever since. He's produced hundreds of informative, emotional, and technically superb videos. He shared his expertise, storytelling, and counsel with people in every department, including the sheriff and the district attorney. He's kept us on the cutting edge, insisting technology be current. And like those first commissioners, he has kept the record, capturing what Multnomah County and its commission are doing and preserving it in an archive for future generations. Mark retires June 20th after 15 years. We are incredibly grateful for his service. In his film, Flight of the Navigator, which I think just went off Netflix but is still on YouTube, the young boy David asks Max, "Will I ever see you again?" "I don't know," Max says, "but we must start the journey. Hold on tight." So, Mark, see you later, Navigator. Thank you for everything. Thank you to the team and the board. And before we take questions, we have one more short video.
People are super appreciative for the services that we provide and are really thankful. And so that makes us feel good knowing that we're in the right places, that we're making that difference.
Help is coming, things are changing, services are being ramped up.
I absolutely love that I get to be a part of maybe reducing some of that human suffering.
I feel like unstoppable. Like, I feel like I definitely get another chance in life.
Test out the hardest possible things with ranked choice voting, just to make sure that we're stress testing how we're preparing as an office.
DCJ believes that people can change, and we want to give them the tools and resources to help them do so.
The proper thing to do is to replace the entire approach. Close the bridge, unfortunately, does have impacts to folks.
We're still out there, and we're working our hardest to manage it so that everybody can have a nice, delightful summer.
This is a remarkable milestone. We're proud to announce that Preschool for All will be serving quadrupled the number of children served since the program's inception.
Today is the day I've been looking forward to for a very long time. I'm thrilled to announce that we are filling the gap next week with the opening of 13 sobering beds to join the deflection services already provided here.
Within my personal experience, just being where I am now, I don't think would have happened without Sun.
This is an exciting day for Multnomah County. I think we've got an array of people here who are equal to this challenge.
There's really no way to sugarcoat this. We had more dogs come into our shelter over the last year than at any time since 2012.
Today, I am declaring an emergency for Multnomah County. Our goal is to provide support for folks to stay safe, warm, and cared for.
So it's important to get people indoors in a warm place as soon as possible.
Heat is something that we're thinking about all year, but we want to make sure we've got a resource that's available for them.
Any form of voter intimidation, disruption, blocking of access, or vandalism will not be tolerated. We will respond swiftly, and they will be investigated to the fullest extent.
It's called a wraparound service.
That's right. And it wraps our whole neighborhood.
It wraps around the whole neighborhood.
That's right.
By being inside, you can see people's physical change and mood lift.
You guys save our lives because there's times that we want to give up. And I'm just grateful to have this village.
I'm so happy to be here. I can't even tell you how it feels for me, you know, to be able to get up in the morning and be safe.
Just going to treatment, like, I got all this help. And I'm, like, successful today. And I get to show up for her. Today, I'm there 24/7. And life's good today.
Thank you, Julie. Julie always has the tearjerker video just to really.
Between you and the animal service.
Yeah. Because you guys are really good at what you do. And I want to just thank the entire communications team for being here today. So thanks, everybody, for taking the time to be here for the presentation. So questions for Julie and Dennis. Okay.
I don't have any questions for you.
Okay.
Great job.
I'll ask a question.
Because I know you guys are excellent question fielders.
With the Preschool for All position, I am curious, is that more communication to potential families or to the general public? Or
it's a great question. We think that there's a gap, that a couple things. The program is really good at reaching folks, but those are the folks that have contact with the program. And there's a population of parents, there's a population of potential providers, members of the workforce, and the public, just in general, that we feel we could really be able, I mean, we have done very little communication beyond responding to essentially news stories that are often based on erroneous information. We don't feel like there's been a clear creation of information that helps the public understand what the program is about, what families experience, what the workforce potential is, what the community's investment is paying for. And so our goal would sort of be able to do more proactive work, some of which you've seen in other programs. So that would be the goal. Again, knowing that the program has some terrific engagement with people who are already in contact, this would be around that.
Thanks. And this isn't a response to your response. It's just a thought. I know from my other professional life that there's way more people who want a slot that can get a slot. So, a wondering I have is, like, we've already communicated to a large group of people, and then there's a group of people who, like, didn't get a slot. So I'm wondering, are we communicating? So the question is, like, we've probably communicated a lot, but have we communicated to the right people? So that'd be one question. But if we continue to communicate and we don't have slots, sort of like we're people feeling disappointed. And then I guess the other question I have, and this is just sort of an overarching theme around all of our budgets, and if you've been listening in this past week, you'll know that I'm concerned about, is that a full-time position? Because I think about like the video you just showed of all the things you're doing, and then having one just for this, it goes to the, you know, we have portions of the county, I feel like their budgets are being completely starved because they're dependent on general fund, and those that have dedicated revenue streams, whether it's the risk fund or preschool for all, or, you know, SHS, a whole variety of things, like they have a dedicated stream. And so I don't know necessarily what my question is, but I'm kind of just wondering whether that's a full-time position given all the other comms.
So I think that based on the demand that Preschool for All already puts on our team, it is at the sacrifice to the general fund and the rest of our programs that we simply cannot get to because we do not have so we have tried, we're not doing either job well. We've tried to be the communications arm for Preschool for All with the larger external public and the press. And I think while we've worked really, really hard, we haven't achieved what I think we could. And at the same time, we've drained away from other programs by the sheer demand. The amount of public inquiry into Preschool for All and the sort of misinformation is just, we have not had the ability to address adequately, and at the same time, it's drawn, I think, on our existing resources. So it actually does hurt the programs that rely on general fund as well. So I think both are true. I take your point about, definitely hear what your concerns are about setting false expectations or those things, but I feel like this would be a way to address needs that would actually serve the greater county in a more holistic way.
Yeah. I'm interested in, I think we have some audiences other than potential parents that we really need to serve. I do actually think they do a very good job of communicating with families that get in, having signed up and quite literally hearing nothing ever. I would say we probably could communicate more with families that don't get slots, but kind of outside the families with preschool age children, you know, I think one of the things that I worry about is, you know, in our growth trajectory, it's going to become harder to get to that like 9th, 10th, 11th, 1,000th slot than it is to get these earlier slots because, you know, I think we're getting the people who had a natural inclination to want to work with this. We've done some good outreach, but like I think it's going to take a real effort because there are lots of barriers. I mean, God, even the licensing requirements for the physical space of a preschool is a hurdle to be able to find a spot, let alone all the things it takes to then one day be a Preschool for All provider, which, you know, I think is such a thing to celebrate. But I actually look forward to this and am really interested. You know, one of the things that I hope from having a position funded through Preschool for All for Preschool for All Communications is to be able to provide that the public that fact checking, because it confuses people and it makes people have, you know, expectations that aren't correct or information that riles them up that's not actually true. So, you know, I I feel like I wish that we could have that level in many other programs too, but specifically for Preschool for All, I think this is one area that the chatter is so intense, and not being able to have a presence just to be like, actually, this is good, bad, or ugly, this is what the reality is, I think is really important. So I appreciate acknowledging that by trying to cover that without funding, it's becoming an issue for other priorities.
So while I don't have questions, I do just want to share a little bit about, just from the perspective of a former department director and how instrumental you at the time were, in my ability to continue to do the work of the department while it was being slaughtered in the media, to be honest. I think we spent an hour with one reporter talking about shelter utilization and what the dashboards actually meant and really trying to do a lot of education. So I just wanna uplift and appreciate that I felt like we were stuck in a position of being really reactive to media stories, and you are now moving to a space where we are able to be more proactive about some of our programs, and it feels fundamentally different in the county coming back to this version versus what I experienced before. Not that I don't appreciate the work of both, but I'm glad that we're in a different place.
I will jump in and say, I think we had to be reactive because that was, we always will have to be reactive, but I appreciate the resources that we've received in the last couple of years to allow us to push back and be proactive and share things and change the map a little bit. I think we're reactive maybe a little bit less now than we had to be in different ways, and things are breaking through differently. And it is a much better place, let me tell you, from being at that interview with you in the park during COVID was, yes, so, yeah.
I would say that sort of, you know, regionally, I think we are viewed as like the old scarred battle horses who have kind of been through it, and we're kind of got a little sunlight now, and we're going to try to enjoy that.
Thank you both very much. Thank you for all the work. Thanks for the whole team, as I said, and just appreciate all the good work you guys do every day.
Thank you, Chair.
Well.
Cool. So that was our last work session for this evening. For this afternoon? We still have more to come this evening, but are there any amendments that folks have for this afternoon?
I do.
All right, let's go ahead and hear them.
Okay, so first, I am going to, because it's going to be basically broken into pieces. I'm going to rescind the May 20th amendment that I offered on to improve community safety in the district attorney's office. I'm going to rescind that because it's going to show up in a different form. Then I have an amendment to restore funding for after-hours care for animal fostering, for emergency contracted services for animal health for pets in Multnomah County, animal services foster program services as directed by the Department of Community Services for a total of $50,000, offset by $50,000 from the chair's revenue amendment number one. So down. Then this is a budget amendment that I am sharing on behalf of Chair Vega Peterson and myself as the co-chairs of LIPSC. I'm just going to read it because it's fairly technical. The Local Public Safety Coordinating Commission is a statutory required, unique, and valuable collaborative body of stakeholders representing diverse parts of the public safety system. LIPSC coordinates local criminal justice policy among affected criminal justice entities. To support this charge, staff support LIPSC through coordinating interagency public policy discussions and providing organizational and communication support. LIPSC stakeholders have identified a growing need for data and policy analytics to examine the public safety system and inform decision-making the council and the council subcommittees. The budget amendment is co-sponsored with Chair Vega Peterson to repurpose and reclassify the current 1.0 FTE strategic initiative managers to 0.5 FTE data analysts and 0.5 FTE policy analysts to reflect current staffing needs for the local Public Safety Coordinating Commission. So that's that one.
So this is revenue neutral.
It's revenue neutral. And I'll just say this is, we came into Lipstick, we're actually operating without any, just keep passing it, without any data trends. Then this next one is amendment on behalf of Commissioner Moyer and myself to increase behavioral health pathways and improve outcomes for individuals in the public safety system related to the, how appropriate, to the district attorney's office. So Commissioner Brim Edwards and Moyer propose an amendment that restores a total of $417,049 for two FTE in the district attorney's budget in the following program areas: $205,064 for one FTE treatment court unit deputy district attorney, $211,985 for one FTE civil commitment deputy district attorney, offset by $417,049 from three FTE vacant county positions. And I'll have another one, but I'll wait for tomorrow.
Okay, thank you. Any others?
Yeah, I got a couple. I'm going to start with a budget amendment related to the Complaints Investigation Unit. It's a reduction and clarification of role amendment. I also have a HR-related budget amendment in order to move HR in a direction of alignment with best practices related to HR to overall staff ratios, streamlining, and consistency. I am proposing some realignment and position freeze savings. HR, and then my final one relates to the capital development plan. So I'm going to spend the money I just saved. And that's to fully fund the loan for Memorial. So that's an additional $1 million. So it's in addition to the amendment previously put forward for $500,000. So we're now at, if the two amendments and the chair's recommended budget were to go forward, it would be $2.5 million for the construction of the memorial, $50,000 as starting capital for the loan for long-term maintenance fund, $500,000 in one-time only capital investment to create, to convert our two gendered restrooms outside of the boardroom into one large multi-store stall gender-neutral restroom. You can see this in some of our libraries. We've used this approach. I am also putting the issue of the ADA ramps on the table for capital construction, and am looking for an analysis of our legal exposure by not moving forward more rapidly to be in compliance with the ADA. And then I'm asking DCA to look at all owned or leased space that is vacant to see if it is suitable for use for either an infant toddler childcare or a preschool for all site, and asking DCA to report back at the end of 2025. And I'm adding in that, so that's a budget note, I'm adding also a budget note related to looking at our capital construction process for new buildings related to improving the process in order to drive down costs and looking for ways in which we can identify key decision points that would give DCA greater direction toward the overall cost that we are willing to allocate toward a project. So that's those are my budget notes.
Great, thank you.
Once we get them, can we just ask? Once we get them, can we just ask you a couple questions just so we understand them? What you all just read, that's all in this piece of paper.
What
you just shared on all the capital projects is on this piece of paper, okay?
Yeah.
So I just want to make sure, again, this is just so I understand. So first of all, the HR, this, what is this paying for? Or what are you using the savings for, the Medicaid? No.
No. This is new. It's to, so I don't do exactly a total offset. I'm creating some additional funds, and then my capital construction, although I would probably want to move one-time only dollars to the capital construction and move the ongoing general fund savings to something else we're using one-time only dollars for. But I am proposing an additional $1 million for loan for $500,000 for gender-neutral restrooms. And then...
Are you paying for that with the ADA ramps, maybe?
No. Then there is a little bit of excess, but I'm bringing up and wanting a little guidance related to our legal exposure on ADA compliance due to our minimal investment in ADA. Yes.
So where are you getting the money for a loan for? Sorry.
The HR one is a $1.5 million savings, so $1 million of the $1.5.
Okay.
Well, $1,050,000 of the $1.5 can come from that. Again, I'd probably want to move it around.
Right, so you're paying the same color of money. Okay.
Yeah.
And then, so that's because we...
I'm printing more money than I'm spending because I've... I'm not printing because these are only policy suggestions, which may or may not work, move forward. But my reductions, if adopted, would create savings over what I am suggesting. But I am also acknowledging that, one, they may not be adopted in their completeness, and second, there are previous amendments that are using funds that have already been identified in other amendments.
So just to keep going on this, the gender-neutral public bathrooms, the $500,000, is that just a ballpark number, or is that based on...
That is based off of some work that was done 2 years ago by DCA at the request of then-COO Cruz to look at doing that. And so they did some preliminary...
Okay.
Look, and so I would call that a rough estimate, but it is from DCA, not my own personal okay. use of what it should cost.
And then, just so I understand, the ADA ramps, it's not an add or subtract, it's looking at potential liability?
Correct.
Okay. And then...
I just want
to... The other ones are just our budget notes.
Correct.
Okay, sorry. And then... Yeah, the HR, $1 million of it is going to loan for, and where's the other 500? This is where the extra.
This is where I get.
Well, I could have dropped my amendment then if there's extra.
I'm not sure everything I've put forward will be adopted.
Okay. And then I'm just curious about the complaints investigation unit. So you're just getting rid of it? No.
It's a staff reduction of 50%, but the remaining individuals would solely do protected class HR investigations. as part of it, integrated into HR.
So there's currently six FTE, and you're reducing it by three.
Yeah. No. In my proposal, I would not move that one FTE because I don't want to get rid of that FTE, but it doesn't fit in a complaints investigation.
Okay. Thank you for explaining.
And I have some questions about the HR positions you've identified. Are those all in central HR or some of those in department? Like where are these different?
These five are in central.
Central HR.
And if I'm wrong, I will correct that, but I'm pretty sure these are the ones that are in central.
Yep. Okay, any more questions or amendments? All right, great. That concludes our budget work session for this afternoon. Our next meeting is our last public hearing on the budget scheduled for today at 6 p.m. This is a 100% virtual public budget hearing. So we will see folks and invite folks to join us online tonight at 6 p.m. There being no further business, we are adjourned.